Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live. We are in Ottawa, Ontario, at the University of Ottawa as part of Congress 2015. It is the first day of the CHA part of Congress 2015. And I think I might win the prize this year for the person who traveled the least distance to get here. I live about a 7-minute walk from this building. So it's really nice compared to when we're in Victoria, say, and you have to fly across the country. So I'm really excited about this week, if for no other reason than I haven't had to go anywhere. And we'll have a lot of fun at Congress, as we always do. And our first episode, as part of the series of Congress episodes that we do every year, we're very excited because we have an author who has written the definitive book in his subject, as it says on the book jacket. And that is Michelle Hoag from Carleton University. He has written a book entitled Métis and the Medicine Line, Creating a Border and Dividing a People, with the UNC Press in the United States and the University of Regina Press in Canada. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sean.
I'm really excited to have you here. And this book has been very well reviewed.
It has, at least internally, but from the people that the press found to review it. Mm-hmm. So it's very gratifying.
Yeah, and I went through it yesterday, and I enjoyed it. And it's an interesting subject matter, given these notions of nationhood and construction and racial elements. But overall, just for people who probably haven't read the book yet, what is the overall point of the book? What are you talking about here?
Well, the impetus for the book was to try and understand how it is that this group of peoples, the Plains Métis, the communities that are at the heart of this study, what happens when these communities would really emerged in the beginning of the 19th century at the same time and at the same place where the efforts to mark the international boundary between Canada and the United States started. So what happened over time to try to trace those projects of Métis ethnogenesis and nation building to see how it is that these communities interacted with those processes of boundary making. And what it shows is really a set of stories that I think complicates what we think we know about the process of creating the 49th parallel. That in a sense, it's true that over time, as the subtitle suggests, that the border became more significant in the lives of Plains Métis and other Plains Indigenous peoples. But at the same time, there's sort of a sub-story as well about how these communities were actually influential in the making of those boundaries. So there's a kind of reciprocal process that we don't think we fully appreciated in narrating, Plains Métis history or the history of Plains Indigenous peoples, that these communities were actually at the heart of border making.
Because I think a lot of people would think of it as these were victims of this process, but really they're more active than simply being at the mercy of what's happening.
That's right. And I think, partly is that the book tries to trace the story over almost a century. And so that story does change. And ultimately when I sort of leave this story in the 1920s and 1930s, it's easy to sort of see a kind of story of demise or declension. But I tried to sort of correct that or to fight against that. And particularly when you look at the longer trajectory, like you say, that for, much of the 19th century, groups like the Plains Métis exert a tremendous amount of power, particularly in the northeastern plains, in places like Red River, but even in places south of the border where we haven't been used to, historians haven't been used to looking for them. And certainly in matters of trade and economic matters and military matters and diplomatic matters, they played an important role through the 19th century in shaping how federal officials, imperial officials, others, outsiders, actually see and understand what's going on in the border. And they're implicated in many of the border-making processes themselves.
And the book starts, I really like the way it started, because it starts with the surveyors who are going west and surveying the 49th parallel and their interactions with these people and how that sort of is the starting point for everything that follows. So it's interesting because you have these guys who are out there who are surveyors and just out there working, but that is sort of the first step in this process that goes to very official levels. And it's really interesting how the interactions change over time.
Yeah, yeah, and I really wanted to start with that in part because there's those great photographs, and many Canadians have seen them, right, where it's, there's no more, the boundary, the 49th parallel is, sort of in some ways the quintessential example of the artificial boundary, and there's always the photos of, a marker, this markers sort of sitting in the empty open plain. But by starting there, I wanted to start in the 1870s, which is really the midpoint and really is sort of the pivot point for the story, and showing in that survey how the actual labor, for example, and much of the expertise and the guiding and that sort of the sort of work, the day-to-day work of the survey was actually closely linked to the Métis communities that the surveyors encountered along the way. But it also represents a kind of turning point, representative of the states, both states, Canada and the United States, to have a firmer sort of administrative presence and to begin to put weight behind their claims to on the plains.
Mm-hmm. And two, it goes along with the changing use of the land there, too, and how this affects everybody. Now, before we get into all this, though, you have, at the end of the introduction, almost a disclaimer in terms of usage, the vocabulary you use, because the term Métis is somewhat contested. And I'm not an expert on this by any means, but I believe the first time we met was as part of a Métis research project that I was there simply to take notes and do some administrative work because nobody would want me for content at that type of project. So I'm sort of familiar with how contested that term is. But when you're talking about Plains Métis, how do you define admission into that group?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I have to tell you, the reason that figures prominently in the introduction is because, like you say, it's such an important topic, but it's also one that's very difficult to find a good sort of working solution to. The problem, and I use the word Métis capitalized, no accent, in order to signal, without the accent, that these are groups who, although primarily can trace their ancestry to Cree, Soto, Assiniboine, and French-Canadian roots, that there is actually a much more diverse set of ancestries represented, and that's the reason for removing the accent in that case. But, you know, I say in the introduction that, you know, using Métis is difficult in some ways, and maybe anachronistic in a sense. A lot of these folks may not have identified as such. Certainly some would have been identified by others as half-breeds and may have self-identified as such, or they may have used a variety of different names, whether that name's in Michif, in Cree, or Assiniboine, or what have you. And it's likely that their attachments and how they identified sort of varied over time and situationally. So what happens is, for those of us who rely quite heavily on archival records, these are difficult groups to track and difficult groups to name. And so I found myself making all kinds of decisions about how to talk about these groups. And I went with Métis because the people that I talk about in this group can be traced sort of ancestrally to sort of core Métis communities, or communities that became sort of identifiably Métis beginning in the early 19th century.
And is there a big difference between the self-identification of these people and the way in which they are identified by the official organizations in Ottawa?
Now, quite possibly. I mean, it becomes a really big issue in the United States in particular, where, you know, the label Métis has not really meant very much until recently, where I think it's enjoying a kind of resurgence. So you see that definitely in places like Montana, for example, where that label Métis would not necessarily have, you wouldn't carry with it any kind of recognition. Mm-hmm. And so I try to trace the historical process behind that and why it is that label gets forgotten or never carries the same kind of weight. You know, in terms of the difference between self-identification and what others see them, I'll have to admit that we're always a little hamstrung in the sense that, you know, when looking at the 19th century, you're looking at peoples who appear in sort of fragments in the archives and are often labeled as generically as half-breeds, you know, which could mean many different things. And so you're left trying to read contextually to try and see if these are, in fact, those references are to people who are connected to the communities that you're interested in.
Mm-hmm. And that's really interesting, the difference between, I mean, because you talk about how the border is artificial, and yet the reaction or the way that these groups are treated on both sides of it are so different, which is really quite remarkable. And, of course, race is going to be an element of that. And is there a different? I'm familiar with the way in Canada, like these ideas of, you know, if a woman had married a white guy, she loses her status and all this. Is there significant differences in the racial composition of the group as recognized by governments on either side of the border?
Yes, there is and there isn't. And so that was the starting point in some ways for the study. So why is it that in Canada you have a group that's sort of identified as being Aboriginal, who a recognition fairly early on from, you know, from at least, you know, federally from 1869-70 as being the distinct Aboriginal group as Métis. In the United States, there's no equivalent. And so that was sort of a foundational difference. Mm-hmm. When you look at the way that many of these policies sort of play out over the next, the following decades, though, the ultimate effects of those differences aren't as great as I may have assumed. Okay. In the United States, there's, you know, I think that race is reckoned differently. And that kind of, there's no conceptual category for people of mixed ancestry, like there is, right, or legal category for that matter. And that exerts a particular pressure on reservations and an American Indian policy. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that in Canada, you know, even though the Manitoba Act recognized Red River Métis rights, that, you know, for a long time, that the nature and content of those rights wasn't all that clear. And so mm-hmm. outside of the script system, outside of other sorts of ad hoc policies, it's the what exactly it means to have that recognition isn't all that clear. And so the kinds of pressures that come from not having an adequate land base, for example, and being able to establish land bases around communities is felt, you know, in similar ways on both sides of the border.
And let's talk about this notion of land as well, because you talk about the idea of sovereignty. And sovereignty implies, to me at least, a nation. But the Métis people aren't considered a First Nation because of the mixed ancestry in this country. So there's all these levels to this that's really quite fascinating to consider, and one of which would then be land use. You talk a lot about how these kinship networks that existed in the area that would now cross the border existed for a really long time, but they weren't stationary. They moved around, and it was seasonal land use, or even occasional land use, not necessarily even seasonal, which goes against the European model of land use, which is permanent and ownership. And that causes some problems. And did that affect there's this racial element to it, but did the land use contribute to that racial element where the white settlers are looking at them and saying, well, they don't know how to properly use land?
I think it did matter in a couple of different ways. And this is partly, you see, for example, in the way that the Canadian government, for example, recognizes that Métis have rights by virtue of their Aboriginal ancestry. Mm-hmm. But the way that they settle with those rights, you know, with First Nations, it tends to be through treaties. And there's a collective dealing with the land rights. Mm-hmm. Through the negotiations that are correct treaties. And while people who may identify or be identified as Métis may enter treaties, but they could only do so as members of First Nations bands, or at least that's how it was described. The decision to deal with Métis title individually through scrip, for example, means that while the government takes measures, inadequate measures, as the courts have since ruled, to satisfy Métis script claims individually, it means that, you know, individual applicants can gain the equivalent of, say, homestead applicants, individualized mm-hmm. pieces of land. And that is tied, in a sense, to both, some would argue, to the demands of some of the Red River Métis initially, to the kinds of patterns of landholding that they had in place, but also to, it's not unconnected to notions of race and the ideas that by virtue of the white ancestry in this case, that if you believe, as many people in the 19th century did, the kind of civilizing potential of agriculture, for example, and the importance of private property, that and the potential for improving peoples of mixed races, then holding land in that manner can be something really important. Mm-hmm. For those people who don't opt into that, who are part of those migratory communities that have made the decision to to follow the buffalo herds, for example, and to participate fully in the buffalo economy, that becomes a really big issue. Mm-hmm. Because they're both, in the eyes of policymakers, they're seen as somehow suspect, less capable of being, and less willing to become civilized, to join in that sort of on that path, and it also has I think a really important effect in terms of that kind of mobility, as I say in the introduction, lays bare the continued autonomy and the unwillingness really to buy into those sorts of terms that, mm-hmm. that many Métis communities and other Plains First Nations exhibit into the 1870s and 1880s until the buffalo herds.
And it's an issue that I've always found interesting in that, people come over and they say, well, these people aren't civilized. Well, I've always found that confusing because how do they think that they've lived? I mean, yes, the definition of civilized differs, sure, but to say that is, it's so beyond the pale of mm-hmm. rational or reasonable. Mm-hmm. So it never made sense to me. But at the same time, is it simply a case of misunderstanding in that in Europe, you don't have as much land to deal with? So the people who are coming over are so used to having to stay on a set piece and having this ownership that they simply don't recognize the difference in the availability of land. And, I mean, you can't have this migratory mm-hmm. system yeah. in Western Europe mm-hmm. in the last, 2,000 years or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. There's not enough space to do that. So is it that simple?
Well, I think you're right in the sense that it's a question or a dilemma that many migratory peoples who are identified as nomads, mm-hmm. From around the world get... are presented with in the 19th century, and I think you read John Locke and notions of property and what gives people claims to property mm-hmm. and anything that's not improved through labor, right, is land that has no value, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it goes quite deep into Western European ideologies, and I think that it becomes, I think, sort of a foundation of settler colonialism. And so I think that, in a sense, there is something deeply self-serving about this, and there's no doubt that for many people these ideas are deeply held, but there's something self-serving in that when Canadian and American officials look to the West, they see an imagined West which is in which migratory or mobile Plains peoples are replaced by sedentary settlers who will, live within nicely bounded tracts of land. And I think that's what I try to trace in the book, is that in a sense, it's that transition from that mercantile fur trade economy in which, First Nations and Métis play critical roles. Mm-hmm. And those notions of migration and mobility don't matter. In fact, they're hardwired into the success of mm-hmm. those fur trade economies. But by the late 19th century, those economies have a lot less appeal. And right. as governments want to replace them with agriculture, then these are when these notions really emerge and gain power.
Mm-hmm. And how does that idea of land usage then correspond with the border and the construction of this mm-hmm. border? And are they hand in hand in that now that we have this boundary as defined politically, then we have to start making use of this land? I know Canadian history is full of, in the West, of this concern of Americans coming north. So is it part of this push? Obviously, the Americans are going west with this manifest destiny idea. And then is the Canadian government saying, well, we have to do this to stop them from expanding north, and therefore we have to push these migratory people out?
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to one of your questions earlier on, in the sense, and the other reason to start with that survey is that survey becomes the essential starting point for a whole bunch of other surveys.
Right.
But that the boundary survey that's conducted in the 1870s is essential so that other sorts of key lines can be drawn, so that the basic grid survey that takes hold in the North American West can be done. So it's the essential starting point for for parceling out that land. So in that sense, yes, the border is important. Settling those sorts of territorial claims is absolutely essential to laying the kind of basic infrastructure for settlement, mm-hmm. Resettlement, that will occur in both the United States and Canada. In Canada, you know, as we know from Canadian history, the different pace of settlement in Canada versus the U.S. West creates a basic asymmetry that the border comes to stand in for. Right. And like you say, that often is manifest in a sense of threat, you know, mm-hmm. About annexation, about concern, Canadian concern about the border, and about the threat that Canadian claims are not as strongly held or not as easily defended as those in the United States. So it's mm-hmm. very, very... it becomes very important, and as I suggest, you know, in a sense, Métis play a key role in both feeding that anxiety, but also helping Canadian officials also see and understand that border region.
Now, we should talk about this idea of the borderland too, and you know, obviously, the borderland is where the border is, but there's different conceptions of a borderland for official folks in Washington and Ottawa. And for these people themselves, because they have borderlands depending on their networks and their relationships. So it's different from, you know, the colonial understanding of a borderland. So how did those two concepts clash?
It's a great question. And it's and that's, I think, the problem sometimes with that concept is that it can be used, and it's a very malleable concept. It can be used in many different ways. And one of the ways I try and think about it is that, you know, in a sense, it lends itself well to this sort of study in this, if you think about borderlands as places that can be, you know, subject to multiple competing and layered sort of notions of belonging, really. And the obvious one is the sort of borderland that emerges around that sort of territorial boundary of the 49th parallel. But as you say, there are other ones in terms of the kinship networks, the kinds of relationships between different First Nations that are shifting, both in terms of their human relations, but also in the lands that they occupy. It's hard to trace a straight line through those different attachments. But what's interesting is that one of the ways that border sort of, you know, transitions from that kind of fiction to something that's very real is that you see that many of these First Nations and Métis communities that are along the border also begin to invest meaning in the political boundary as well. So one of the ways it's made real is through the actions and investments of Plains Indigenous peoples. And so, you know, we see that notably in the book in instances where people seek sanctuary on one side of the border, you know, to escape, you know, police or military or what have you. Or they claim, you know, to be American or claim to be Canadian, sometimes both at different times in their lives, and in a sense, what they're doing is, they're at least at those moments buying into those sorts of divisions. Mm-hmm. So over time, that, you know, I think that you do get not a smoothing out, but a confluence where that creates, I think, a more singular borderland over the course of that century.
But that's a fundamental shift for those people. Changing their concept or their understanding of what a border is.
I think so. I think that one of the arcs of the story is in a sense how, you know, people like the Métis help make the border initially, but the border also remakes them over time. Right. And that's not true just of them. I think that's true of any people who live along the border. I mean, it's not an insight that I can sort of lay sole claim to. Other people who look at, say, the Mexico-U.S. border have found, you know, similar experiences, or in Africa or in Europe even, that over time, you know, the legal powers that states invest, you know, in those borders and what happens to individual status as people move back and forth, those exert power over communities. And so in the case of the Métis, the kinds of legal definitions that exist on one side of the border and or the other over time will affect the shape of those communities in important ways.
How do they understand it? Because the border, even today, isn't all that well patrolled. I mean, it's obviously better patrolled today than it was then. But and this notion that, I mean, I do radio, so, I mean, radio waves don't care that there's a line there. They're just going to do what they do. The same way that, I mean, if they're hunting buffaloes, the buffalo don't care that there's a line there, nor do natural resources care. I mean, we see this now with the oil sands and this idea that it's starting to, it's further south than we thought it was. Mm-hmm. And what does this mean? Mm-hmm. So that, it is an artificial line that these people for thousands of years didn't care about. Mm-hmm. Animals don't care about, the resources don't care about. And given that there isn't a strong presence enforcing this line in the 19th century, how do they come to recognize it and understand it?
There are a couple of ways. There are moments, I think, when that enforcement is, in fact, very real and surprisingly real. So in ways that I think are surprising in that, for example, and the quintessential moment is in around 1885 during the events of the Northwest Resistance. Sure. That, you know, over the late 1870s to the early 1880s, the American military presence along the border has increased tremendously. And you're right, it's never a kind of sealed border. There's no wall. There's no kind of, surveillance apparatus like we'd understand it today. But it's a surprisingly effective at different moments, and there's a much sort of enhanced presence. When the conflict breaks out on the banks of the South Saskatchewan and across different parts of the Canadian Northwest, it's actually quite interesting to see how the network of patrols sort of gets activated in Canada and in the United States to really monitor that. And it's never ever sealing off the border and preventing people from crossing, but it is actually, reasonably effective in at least being able to track movements. Mm-hmm. So people can cross it, but when Gabriel Dumont and others leave Saskatchewan to take refuge in Montana, people in Ottawa and people in the United States are aware of those movements pretty quickly because of the network of informants that they have, because of the patrols that they do. So in that sense, there is an element of greater enforcement, I think, than we've understood. But you're right, it never is the kind of barrier. But people do feel it, for example, so that they can cross the border freely, but it is manifest in what rights they're accorded when they're on the other side. So people, for example, that are members of the longstanding Métis communities that have been in Montana in the mid-19th century, when they attempt to get a homestead or vote and do all these sorts of things, then it's those moments when you have to interact with the state that those issues about who you are and where you belong become apparent. Mm-hmm. So in the day-to-day, it's not always as clear, but in those moments of interaction, then that's when those questions are more deeply felt.
You talk about how there's different reactions or different dealings with the state on each side. Is there cooperation between Canada and the United States to ensure, if not equal treatment, but similar treatment?
There's cooperation for sure. I don't know if it's so much to ensure treatment. In the 1870s and 80s, it's to monitor what are perceived to be military threats, particularly after 1880. I think that there's a real turning point in around 1882. For a long time, the Canadian government has actually no interest in stopping the movements of not just Métis, but a lot of Canadian First Nations that are hunting in the United States, because they understand that the longer that they do, they continue to subsist as they've always done, that the longer the Canadian government can delay having to make that transition onto reserves. So they're not in any interest in, they have no interest in cooperating. That begins to change in the 1880s when you have those large congregations in the Cypress Hills, and it's been the focus of Jim Daschuk's work, for example. And when it looks as though some of those groups are organizing politically to revisit the treaties or to ensure that the Canadian government fulfills its treaty obligations, the Canadian government comes on side pretty quickly with the United States. And that level of cooperation begins to grow. And then you see that fully in 1885 and after. What you see after that is, I can't claim to have traced this fully, but there is a level of interaction between the bureaucracies that sometimes, for example, there's a great concern of duplication of services, so that some people, whether First Nations, whether Métis, should not get, benefits on one side if they're getting it on the other, those on the other. So there's a kind of cooperation in that regard. Mm-hmm. And then it comes and it goes at different moments. So there is always a shared interest in general terms between the Canadian and the American governments, but really only after 1880 is that sort of manifest in a kind of closer cooperation.
Does it change fundamentally from a situation of, we're trying to figure our administrative system out to, well, these people are now dangerous?
I think so. I mean, I think that
It's aggressive. It goes from. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can make the argument that it was always aggressive,
mm-hmm, sure,
but now it is more of a violent aggressive.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, I don't think it's phrased in those terms, but there's a hardening in the language that you see in that correspondence that's written in Ottawa, for example. And for a long time, you know, it's in the Canadian government's self-interest, and there's never any denying that. But they will, in their justifications that they send to the British or to American officials in Washington, sort of say, well, of course these people are continuing to hunt. That is what they do. And it's actually impossible to change these patterns. By the early 1880s, when hunting is not really an option in the same way, the Canadian government begins to talk about implementing pass systems, those sorts of things that would clamp down on that kind of movement. They don't necessarily. It's only in 1885, I think, when there's absolute concerns of sort of a pan-Indian uprising that will spread across the border, when it's phrased in terms of threat in that sort of way. I would argue, though, that, you know, you can see that even before in terms of those recurring stories all through, you know, Western Canadian history about the threat of Indian uprising. And I think that there are moments when that finds its way into the correspondence.
Right. Well, because you talked about, you know, people using the border for their own, for when it suited them, they could use it advantageously. And like Louis Riel, like, he did that.
Sure.
I mean, he went to the United States. And I mean, and that's, I think, the most famous case. But that could be a situation where governments on both sides of the border say, okay, now this is a situation where this could be potentially dangerous. Now we really have to do something to either lock down the border or stop the migration back and forth, because we can't allow this anymore. It sets a precedent when somebody who is considered a felon in one country or dangerous, if they could just cross, well, then what's going on? And it's not secure for... Even if you don't look at it in the broader scale of the colonial mindset going west, just for the settlers who are there, or the communities that are there, if there is a dangerous individual who's allowed to roam back and forth, that could be dangerous for those people.
Well, yeah, and you see, you see that with Riel to some degree, but with Gabriel Dumont and the folks who are affiliated, who led the Northwest Resistance, that for years afterwards, the American government, the Canadian government, follow him. And they have networks of informants and in places in Montana and North Dakota. And there are letters in the Northwest Mounted Police files that speak to his different actions that he took. And they're opening mail that you know, if for example, there are instances where people in the communities in the Turtle Mountain Reservation, North Dakota, mixed Métis reservation, you know, write to relatives in Saskatchewan, they have their mail opened, and they go and they find people who translated them or are able to speak to the contents of those messages in order to track down what it's what's happening. That there is a persistent concern then that there is possibility for further unrest. So it's amazing how long that persists.
Now, the subtitle of the book is Creating a Border and Dividing a People, so that obviously implies that the border separated these networks. And I mean, we've talked about how the Plains Métis changed through the border, but how were they separated?
Well, a couple of things. And, you know, one that was the fine line that I had to walk here is, on the one hand, there's no, I think, question that the arc of the story, is one in which that border becomes more defined and people are, communities are increasingly fractured, particularly those communities that in the 1870s and 1880s, like, literally were on the border. And, they are pushed out militarily in the early 1880s, but they're also pushed out by the decline of the buffalo. So there's two ways, I think, that fracturing and the separation occurs. One is that the material basis for those communities is gone, right? That these are communities that grew up because of the buffalo trade, and without the buffalo, there's the basis for those communities sort of falls out. And so, you know, there's a movement to different places to set to, whether it's to places like Lewistown, Montana, or the front range of the Rocky Mountains in Montana, or to the Parkland Belt in Canada. So there is a kind of separation that happens there. It doesn't mean the end of movement, though. And that's true even after that really intense period of the late 1880s, that people continue to move in search of jobs, for other kinds of search of land. They hear of opportunities to visit relatives, to do all of those sorts of things. But that becomes, those movements change in scale. They become more conducted at the level of families, for example, individuals, in which the kin networks that sustain these communities are still very much present, but they don't function in the same way. Mm. And that's partly because that whole the economic basis for these communities has changed. They're now moving within a landscape that's essentially, you know, defined by ranching and agriculture,
right.
You know, in which they occupy very different roles and are often pushed to the margins of that new economy. Mm. And so the separation is an economic one, and, mm-hmm. and it's a question of resettlement and reorienting the lands and economies of that part of the Prairie West or the North American West, and that has the consequence of changing the nature of those sorts of movements.
And I would imagine that race would be a big issue there, because as that economy changes, race would be a barrier to entry into that new economy, yeah. whereas before it wouldn't be as much for the hunting, right?
Often, yeah. And you see it. It's an important barrier in the United States as well, for example, for, you know, Métis individuals, men at least, can vote often. They can apply for homesteads as long as they naturalize. But in order to be naturalized as an American citizen, you have to be identified as white. So race is a tremendous barrier for those people who can't identify or be identified in that way. So it at the same time, by virtue of their mixed status, we see some of these communities who found homes on Indian reservations in Montana get kicked off because they're of mixed ancestry. Mm. So when in the 1920s some of these communities in the U.S. formalized their enrollment rolls, that they're subject to, their connections to the community are subject to scrutiny. Mm. And those notions of race also, you know, become really important in terms of deciding who can stay and who can go.
So really, I mean, the mobility is limited because of the natural situation of the buffalo dying off. But then you have this border that is starting to harden, and so that limits mobility. And now that you have to become more stationary, you are limited racially from two sides, the First Nations who may not want to allow entry because that might compromise their situation. Mm-hmm. And then with the settlers who have these racial biases, it's really a very untenable situation.
It is, yeah, and it's felt on both sides of the border. It's felt more acutely, I think, in Montana, in part because of what it seems as though the communities, the Métis communities there, and are sort of caught in a double bind of being identified as neither Indian nor white, but also as being foreign, being British or Canadian. And that sort of sets up these sorts of dual exclusions that are very durable, very hard to escape. And you see it in the creation of large landless populations in Montana, people who are not all of whom we'd identify as Métis or who would identify as such, but who were part of those mixed borderland communities that included Plains Ojibwe, Soto, Cree, and others, that spend and are still in some ways seeking a kind of federal recognition for recognition of their land rights. And so you see on the edges of Montana's cities, towns and cities, these landless communities, indigenous communities, who are quite literally on the margins.
Right. But then why is there this idea of, in Canada, the Métis, at least now, I mean, I know there's national associations and there's a strong presence, there's awareness of the Métis people. Why does that happen in Canada, not in the United States, when, you know, you're saying that the situation in the early 20th century is similar in both countries?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really good question. So there are a couple of possible ways to answer that. One is the size of the Métis communities and their attachments to places in what becomes the Canadian Northwest are more noticeable. Some places like Red River, we know that there's a tremendous dispersion of Métis from Red River, but you know, many people remain. And that's true all through the Parkland Belt and places like Batoche and the South Branch communities, Edmonton, all of those places, and to the north, of course. So there are these communities that have, there are core communities that remain and are durable and stable and are identifiable. But there also is, you know, these are communities that have long, long histories of interactions with others in terms of whether that was through the fur trade and others, other entities. And, you know, in the Canadian sort of federal experience, there's lots of, they have lots of experience dealing with Métis communities. Much of it's not a happy right. narrative, but there's an understanding of who these people are, and that longer duration of the fur trade economies in which, you know, Métis played a fundamental role really does sort of set a different tone. So by the 1930s, in you know, when there is a kind of resurgence in Métis political organizing, there are people, you know, in place, right? Those folks who are able to reignite the kinds of political traditions that existed in the 19th century and to bring them to the fore. And there's a critical mass in these prairie communities that doesn't exist south of the border as much south of the border.
Does language play a role too? Because, you know, I mean, the general way people consider or think of Métis is the descendants of First Nations women and the French fur traders, and the strong French presence in Canada. That doesn't quite exist in the United States to the same extent. Is that a factor, the French ancestry of some of these folks?
I'm not sure about the French ancestry. I think language is critical, and just any kind of cultural traditions that are at the heart of you know, it goes back to your earlier question of who these communities are and how do you define them.
Yeah.
Well, in some ways they define themselves by their kin networks, but also the cultural practices, their shared histories, their shared languages, whether that's Michif or other Aboriginal languages, and the kinds of cultural activities that are sort of at the heart of these communities, you know, those are easier to sustain, you know, in communities that are larger.
Yeah.
And so I think that it does play a role in that sense, that, you know, the larger presence of French in Canada, I'm not so sure about that.
Okay. Now, I've left this to the end because I don't know if people really want to hear about methodology, but I'm going to ask about methodology because I think it's important for this. Because you talk about how there's the written record is very much the official version of what happened. And these kinship networks operated through these relationships and through discussions. I mean, how much... Because none of these people, we're talking about 19th century, none of these people are alive anymore, obviously. So how do we trace them in a way that we can really understand not only their movement? I mean, movement might be a little easier than their relationships, their understanding of the border, and what they thought of what was going on, how they understood the situation. How do you go back and try and figure that out?
Yeah, it's a fundamental question, really. And it's one that I think requires a lot of humility and understanding the limits of your research and your knowledge. So there's something about the act of publishing a book that gives it the impression of finality. When it made it hard to let go of this one because I can't help but think this is terribly incomplete. And my knowledge of this has changed a great deal, in part as I work with colleagues here at the University of Ottawa and the kind of work that they're doing, looking at those sorts of archival traces and genealogical data and the work that they're doing to sort of give those, to bring those to life through networking, social networking, and mapping those social networks has really helped me revisit some of what I had encountered in the initial phases of this research. That's, I think, very promising, a promising line of inquiry that I think helps us when read, genealogical data, when read alongside historical, other kinds of historical records and other sorts of cultural records, the understandings of what community means or what it means to be a godparent, for example, or something like that, can help us sort of understand the shape of these communities in ways that has been hard mm-hmm. to do. That said, I can't overstate the difficulty in terms of just trying to piece together a kind of archival record of these stories. It's incredibly difficult, and you hope that in piecing that together, you are not doing damage and misrepresenting. I mean, I think that we have to be very cautious, I think, in imputing understanding or making these sorts of comments about how folks saw themselves and how they saw the world around them. When we do that, we need to know that these are at best guesses mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. educated guesses, but mm-hmm. guesses nonetheless. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, because really, how reliable is the textual record? Because, yeah. I mean, a lot of it's going to be very, is coming from official
yeah.
viewpoint of the settlers. And obviously, there's going to be some issues there. So,
sure,
I mean, you could probably believe when they say, "Well, this group of people was here on this day." I mean, that's mm-hmm. probably. I don't know why they would lie about that, but when they discuss their actions, what they're doing, their impressions, I mean, mm-hmm. they have to take that with a huge grain of salt.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think there's no escaping in a book like this. One of the, particularly in the United States, unlike, you know, say what you will about the Department of Indian Affairs mm-hmm. in Canada and the United States Bureau of Indian Affairs, this is a tremendous bureaucracy that exists to document and to, mm-hmm. you know, document American and Canadian Indian policy. And that creates a tremendous archive. Deeply problematic archive, but an archive nonetheless. The Métis don't have the same kind of relationship with the state, and so there's no sort of similar body that generates those sorts of archival traces. So in the United States, what I ended up relying on were things like missionary accounts and army accounts and Bureau of Indian Affairs accounts. All of them are problematic in their own ways. And like you say, there are agendas, particularly in the military accounts. In some ways, the military accounts are tremendous because of the level of record keeping and the interest in locating people at a particular time and place, giving numbers, describing. Right. It's interesting, though, in those documents, you do actually see sometimes traces of people, you know, the speeches that they gave, the comments that they said in response to the sorts of encounters that they had with military commanders and the like. You see petitions. You see other kinds of, you know, glimmers of people, you know, not exactly speaking in their own words. It's always mediated, but mm-hmm. there's a surprising amount of those sorts of records. And you look for those, that's for sure. And you do what you can with them. And you, I think, always are trying to triangulate different accounts and trying to find as many versions as you can to see whether you can read through some of these archives.
Like you say, it's incredibly a difficult thing to do and something that I've been fortunate in that I haven't had to do it to the same extent. Because, you know, and that project a few years ago that I sat in on, that Kinship Network project, I mean, the layers of research mm-hmm. that go into it, it's extraordinarily difficult. Yeah. And, you know, and even that, you can have, you know, elders today come and talk and give you a mm-hmm. sense of how it mm-hmm. is too. That's another element mm-hmm. of it. But then there's, you know, the problems with, or the problems, the challenges with oral history that are documented as well. I mean, and really, like you say, it's not so much as coming to anything definitive so much as trying to take a really educated guess mm-hmm. and pinpoint things. So all historical research is an investigation of sorts, but this is really very heavily investigative and going down paths that may not lead anywhere, mm-hmm. and that presents a huge challenge to this type of history.
It does, and like you say, right? Anyone who does historical work to some degree has to engage in this. It is difficult and fraught, I think, right? When you're engaging in research like this, when you're not closely attached to the communities that you're not attached to the communities that you're describing, you know, it's you have to tread carefully, and you hope that what you do is of some use and that brings to light these short sorts of stories that, you know, for example, in this case, that because of the importance of that border, you know, in a sense, it really has acted as an important dividing line for historical inquiry so mm-hmm. that Canadians haven't looked south, you know. And so I'm hoping that the act of trying to piece together stories that move back and forth across the border to bring them into a single location will then provide the opportunity to you know, going forward to amplify the work that's been done here. It really is, you know, kind of starting point. I'm not sure I agree with this definitive status. No, I think that's very kind. I think that there's lots of work left to be done here, and I'm grateful for those comments on the back of the book, but I would suggest that there's much work that remains.
Well, it is an interesting read, and the comment on the front of the book is that it's very well written, and going through it yesterday, it's not a slog historical prose can be. So I enjoyed it, and you know, how about we stick with the important book?
Sure,
we'll go with that. So that is Michelle Hoge, author of Métis and the Medicine Line: Creating a Border and Dividing a People. UNC Press in the United States, University of Regina Press in Canada. He's from Carleton University. Thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks so much.
If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, it's historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.